From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Boston in 2009. A lesbian couple named Sherry and Lois went to live in a senior care facility, but it quickly became clear that they were going to have problems. The women were told that they had to be sick, that gay couples were not accepted. Sherry said that she was not going to hide her sexuality, but Lois decided that if that's the only way to get healthcare benefits, she would go back into the closet for the couple. Their story is part of a documentary film called Gen Silent, which followed the lives of LGBTQ seniors. The film revealed how common it is for LGBTQ Americans to run into legal roadblocks with healthcare, with access, with family. And here's perhaps the hardest part. This aging generation is the one that has fought hardest to come out of the closet, and in some cases now is being forced back into the closet to survive. Trans people are forcefully detransitioned. Gay couples are counseled into psychiatric care. Many gay couples will split, and LGBTQ elders are more likely than the general population to age alone. There are high degrees of alienation and isolation. Well, this weekend there's an elder law fair in our area, but it turns out it's not just for the elder community. For the LGBTQ plus community, there are vital legal issues facing them at younger ages. There are more hurdles to prepare for down the road or questions even now. And this hour, we're having a conversation about what everyone needs to understand, what the law provides, what it does not, and how to handle it. My guests this hour include Katie Adamidis, who is a staff attorney at Legal Assistance of Western New York. Katie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
Also with us is Milo Primo, LGBTQ plus civil rights attorney and founder CEO of Just Roots Consulting, LLC. Milo, welcome to you as well.
Thanks.
I want to just start by asking for the broad view of what's going on this weekend, and then we're going to kind of work our way through these issues that certainly for many of our listeners are not obvious. I mean, and then they can really hit at a bad, bad time for people, and we're going to be kind of talking about the way that happens. But Katie, I'll start with you. What's going on this weekend?
Yes, so tomorrow there's free legal information available at Monroe Community Hospital in the morning. It's called the Monroe County Elder Law Fair, but I urge you, whatever age, if you think you might need information, legal information about healthcare decision making and the other topics we're going to get into today, it's a free event. It's a great chance to learn what you need to know. It starts at 7:45 a.m. bright and early and ends at 12:30 p.m. That's the Monroe County Elder Law Fair at Monroe Community Hospital.
And it's free?
Free.
Free. And so that's a great chance to do that. Milo, what do you think is, what stands out to you about tomorrow? What's the most important part of what the community is going to have a chance to learn tomorrow?
Well, I think that the Elder Law Fair is a great opportunity to bring a lot of different community resources and services available under one roof and get people connected specifically to attorneys and legal services organizations who have a lot of experience and specialize sometimes in preparing legal documents and counseling people in preparing for like worst case scenarios in their health situations. And to the point that you've made already, this applies when we're talking about LGBTQ people, not only to folks who are aging and are elderly, but also folks all along the lifespan who might find themselves in situations navigating a healthcare industry that showers us with disparities and discrimination and bias on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity, and needing to be able to take back the power into our own hands in deciding how our bodies will be treated, what sort of medical treatment we'll need, and who's going to have the authority to make those decisions in the unfortunate event that we become incapacitated.
I remember so many conversations with my friend Scott Fearing over the years, who, you know, when marriage equality was on the line, it was interesting how many people were saying, well, you know, you get this, like that's everything, you know, like, right. Well, it's go home. All the wars have been won. But Scott was always urging all of us to kind of keep in mind, and still does, he still does, that there's so many other possible issues, roadblocks, concerns for gay couples, for people in the LGBTQ plus community, yes, that, you know, you can't just put your eyes on, well, marriage equality nationally, so, you know, and this to me kind of brings that right back, that right, that there are these hurdles. So, Katie, from a legal perspective, are there, for people who thought, well, you know, we passed equality, I thought, you know, couples ought to be, let's take gay couples, for example. What are the possible concerns they have about everything from, you know, partners either visiting, medical decisions, et cetera, and have we seen any change, any progress with that?
Well, of course, with marriage equality comes equality in enjoying the different rights that are conveyed with marriage, but marriage is not a cure-all. So, for example, spouses do not enjoy an automatic power of attorney in the right in the lives of their spouse. So, unless you affirmatively act to appoint an agent under a power of attorney, there is no one who can sell your property without telling you. There is no one who's going to be able to do things like retain an attorney on your behalf. Those are specific rights that only you enjoy, excluding, of course, joint property, which we're not talking about here when I'm talking about an individual's property. But we'll leave all the legal jargon out of it. So marriage, great. It's a great step forward. It's not the same thing as having access to good, sound legal information for advanced care planning and what we call elder law, although I'd really like us to come up with a better term.
Yeah, preparing for this program, it occurred to me we really do need a better term for that.
Yeah, it's something that I like to refer to as quality of life planning, with the idea that we're looking forward to a time in our lives where if we're rendered unable to make decisions about our bodies, about the medical treatment we need, and maybe are not able to come back to a place where we are, you know, able to make those decisions, having some of these documents in place ensures that we have a quality of care by our medical providers, a trusted quality of agency by people that we appoint and that we know and love and trust to make good decisions on our behalf, and also that we are taken care of even after we die, so that, you know, any funeral plannings, any obituaries that are written about us, all of that is taken care of by people that we know and trust. And
I'm glad you brought up the obituaries, because this, again, this may seem sort of like not a central one, but I'm just going to kind of go down a list, because Katie and Milo each provided us with things that are going to come up for individuals, for couples, for families. And I have seen some obituaries that are just rough. You know, you can't believe what family members would have published about people. So one of the examples Milo was kind of emailing about was unsupportive family writing blatantly wrong or really just rude, disrespectful obituaries that essentially strip someone of their status, experience, and agency. I mean, unfortunately, you don't have to look very far to find this stuff. So is there anything you can do about that?
Absolutely. So you can certainly assign somebody the agency of taking care of your property and your bodily remains and everything else. But actually going through the process of pre-drafting an obituary yourself is one way to do it. I actually find this to be a really exhilarating exercise. I know it sounds a little morbid and a little scary. But if you think about it, it's a way for you to say in a nutshell what it is that was important to your life and what you valued and what really was the core of who you are, saying in 3 to 6 words, even, you know, if you had to define yourself in that short of a span, you know, who it is that you are that you want to express to the world. And also using the opportunity to inspire yourself a little bit, to put something in there that says, you know, this is something I actually want to achieve before I go. So I put it down in my obituary. I better get it done, you know, before it's too late.
President but, Primo.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it could happen. I'm just saying. But I think, you know, taking that power and creating a narrative. I mean, as LGBTQ people, every single day we go out into a world that is generally built to be hostile toward us, right? And we have to prove ourselves again and again to be worthy of rights, to be worthy of love, to be worthy of respect. And so to take that last narrative, that thing that endures after we're gone, and to put it back in our hands and have control over it is an exceedingly powerful exercise.
But legally, if you do that, mm-hmm. can you then sort of protect yourself against somebody else publishing about you?
You know, I'd have to do legal research about rights when it comes to obituaries specifically, but I can tell you that if you have done what we call an appointment of an agent to control disposition of remains, then you're affirmatively saying, hey, this is the person who I choose to control what happens to my remains after I die. Usually that bucket of legal decision making goes to what's called commonly next of kin. Usually next of kin also gets tasked with obituaries and things like that. Often it's the case that the people who work in these roles where they're saying, oh, yeah, can you give me something to publish? They're turning to the same people who are in the role, who are contacting the funeral director, et cetera. So it's good practice to have your agents all lined up. And then that way, you know, who's going to be the point person. It's very likely that they're going to have some say.
Okay. But I think it's really smart to get out ahead of it, though, as Milo said.
Yes.
As morbid as it does seem to some of us, while you think cool for you.
Well, I mean, so morbid, any of these conversations are hard, right? When we're talking about advanced health directives, where we're saying, you know, in the event that I'm incapacitated, do I want life-saving treatment? At what point do I want life-saving treatment to end? And we move toward, you know, palliative care and pain management and that sort of thing. All of these things are difficult conversations. Nobody wants to think about these worst case scenarios, but it's so crucially important that we do it. And the truth is, unless you're a robot, we're all going to die at some point. It's an inevitability, death and taxes, right? Those are the two certainties we have in life. So what an exhilarating exercise it is to take control over those last days, weeks, years of your life, to take control over the narrative, to take control over exactly how you want things to go in those last days so that you can ensure that you are respected all the way up until the end. And I think that you can actually ensure that sort of respect ironically, in that way, more so sometimes than you can when you aren't incapacitated. Mm. So
next on the list, trans folks who are forcefully detransitioned by healthcare providers or unsupportive family in a hospital setting, in hospice, nursing homes, even at a funeral. Mm-hmm. And Milo, when we say detransitioned, mm-hmm. I think people have certain ideas on what that means, but that can mean different things in different settings. So tell us what you mean.
So I think it's a really broad term mm-hmm. that really captures any situation where a person's gender identity and gender expression is not going to be respected and maintained by healthcare providers or families over the course of treatment. So the way that this often will play out, let's just say, you know, we have maybe an unmarried transgender woman who has a partner, a lifetime partner, but they're not married. And she has a condition or is in an accident that renders her incapacitated. She finds herself in the hospital. The partner may or may not have a healthcare proxy made to be an agent and have decision-making power. She may not even be able to visit her partner in the hospital. And, you know, next of kin is called. And so maybe we have a mother or siblings who have been estranged for years, who are not supportive of her trans identity, called to make decisions and, you know, use that opportunity to enforce their own views of who this person is mm-hmm. and effectively, you know, strip them of any of the gender expression that allowed them to be who they truly were, reverted back to using a name they no longer use, their dead name, and just really make it so that they're not able to die with the dignity and respect that they deserve. And then carrying that over into funerals and so on and so forth. I know that some states, including California, have passed legislation that specifically makes sure that people are able to die with dignity in this way and that their death certificates will be authentically reflective of the gender identity that they had when they died. So to try to curb that ability of unsupportive family to strip them of that dignity after they die.
Katie, anything to add there?
I just want to take a left turn for a second and talk about life, because I know we're talking about death a lot. I think another lens to view this through is that this is an expression of your values in life, especially if you do a power of attorney. Power of attorney is such a powerful tool to be able to say, if I don't feel well, if I just don't feel like it, here's this person who I trust. Here's this intimacy that I am giving to someone in my life of my choosing so that they can handle my affairs for me. And that's a document that lives and dies with you. So it is a during your lifetime sort of a thing. And it's the intersection of so many things. It's an expression of cultural or religious values. It's an expression of inclusion for people of varying disabilities. So it's not just how are we going to die, which isn't, you know, it's important to talk about. We want to lift that taboo if we can, but there's so much to thinking about the different documents we do. The healthcare proxy lives with you, dies with you. Power of attorney lives with you, dies with you. This is about your life and expression of the kind of life you want, similarly to the way that we express ourselves in so many ways. And so I would just want to kind of put that piece in there too, mm-hmm. But not to take the focus off of detransitioning. And that can be a thing that happens in the hospital when you're temporarily sick, right? Let's say you have a surgery and you're going to recover, but for now you're incapacitated. You don't want to have to be put through something against your will because you didn't do a piece of paper or sign a form.
And it could even, in those circumstances, too, be, you know, who you're roomed with when you're in the hospital for a period of time. If your identity documents have not been amended to reflect your gender identity, sometimes medical professionals will put you in a room with somebody of a sex that you don't identify with. And so now you're in a strange situation where you're having to be outed or come out to medical professionals. And, you know, especially when the vast majority of trans people have mismatching government identity documents that don't all accurately reflect how they are, having these sort of protections in place and making sure there's a healthcare proxy who can say, and an agent who can say, no, this is where they belong, this is how they identify, and we need to be sure to respect and maintain that dignity, is hugely important.
On the subject of documents and identifying, are we seeing change there? And are we seeing change in the way that, say, medical staffs, hospital staffs, in an emergency situation? We're not talking about sort of a long-term care facility,
sure,
nursing homes or like facilities. Now we're talking about emergency medical situations.
Sure.
Are we seeing progress in the hospital for trans Americans?
Sure. Yes and no. I think it depends on where you are. The likelihood of finding an affirming emergency room staff in more urban areas is higher than in more rural regions, and especially in New York State, which is largely rural. This is an ongoing issue for a lot of people. Statistically, LGBTQ people are more likely to utilize emergency rooms as primary care when they are really sick. They also are more likely to postpone seeking care at all when they're sick because they're afraid of bias. And so the emergency rooms are actually a really great place to start when thinking about this. The reality is when a person's gender expression does not match the identity documents they have or the medical records they have, hospitals still lean toward utilizing the sex that they have on record, on the medical records, as someone's quote-unquote true sex or anatomical sex or the thing that they need to focus on. And as a result, a lot of people experience misgendering in the hospital and also homophobia when they're assumed to be straight and not considered having their same-sex relationships considered valid.
I'm in a moment, we'll welcome another guest to the program. Before we do that, I just want to remind you why we're here. The Elder Law Fair is tomorrow, and Katie Adamidis, who's a staff attorney at Legal Assistance of Western New York, is here. Milo Primo is a civil rights attorney, an LGBTQ+ civil rights attorney, and founder CEO of Just Roots Consulting, LLC. The details on tomorrow, once again, Katie?
Tomorrow, bright and early, 7:45 a.m. through 12:30 p.m. at Monroe Community Hospital. It's the Monroe County Elder Law Fair, but it's not just for aging adults. It's not just for older adults. It's for anyone who might need to think about advanced care planning and other documents.
The most misnamed event in the county, the Elder Law Fair.
No shade, Monroe County.
No, it's important. I mean, so many of these issues you don't want to be thinking about for the first time,
right,
when you're in an emergency situation, or if you're in a situation where you feel like you're losing your rights or your civil rights have been violated in some way. There's so much that goes into it, especially for the LGBTQ+ community. I want to welcome Danny Palmer to the program. Nice to have you, by the way. Thanks for being
nice
here.
Nice to meet all of you as well.
Danny, I know they wanted to welcome you to the conversation because of your own experience on some of these issues, at least thinking about the ways it could impact you or has. So I want to kind of just clear the floor and let you tell us a little bit about your own experience on these matters.
Yeah, absolutely. A large part of it for me is that I do have several major chronic illnesses and disabilities, as well as a major psychiatric disorder. So for me, it's a much less associated with aging thing and something that's more so very immediate. And a lot of it is situations where there are very real risks of being unable to make choices for myself, depending on what my health situation is. And I'm sure that it's been touched on kind of already, but for people that are in situations where, for instance, family members can't be relied on to make choices that person would want, which is a case for many people that are LGBTQ in any way, I, until very recently, wasn't even out as transgender to my mother. So if somebody were to call my mom and provide medical information to her, which would be the case in a case where somebody didn't have separate arrangements, that would be, frankly, dangerous to me because that's information that she doesn't have and that I don't honestly know how she would react to. I kind of stopped putting emergency contact numbers on things at a certain point due to that. But there are situations where you don't have that option. And the alternative to that is to have something pre-set up where you can say, I do or don't want to be treated by this facility or this practitioner, or I think that these treatments are appropriate or aren't appropriate. And if you have those things set up ahead of time, it eliminates that uncertainty. It's definitely something that I've relied on because I don't have a long-term partner. I don't have anybody really that would be a logical go-to per se, aside from friends of mine. And that's not the first assumption that a healthcare provider is going to make.
When you talked about the concern of listing any emergency contact, not knowing what they might say, What's a worst case scenario that you can imagine?
I mean, I think if someone were to call my mother, it wouldn't be awful.
Okay.
But if someone were to call my father, that would be a much larger concern. Like, I'm explicitly estranged from him. And that's the thing, is that's not something that somebody's going to look into. It's not something that somebody's going to consider. If they're looking for an emergency contact, they're going to look for the closest available person. And there's contact information for both of those people that would be associated with my record. And if he were to know, I've moved 5 or 6 states away, so it's less of a concern now than it was at that point. But things like being denied care, which is a decision that person gets to make at that point. So if they were to say, you know, do you want to continue treatment for XYZ? Like, somebody could easily say, you know, no, you're not going to be taking testosterone anymore. It's actually happened to several of my friends in particularly psychiatric situations where they're deprived of care that is necessary, regular, has been monitored by a doctor for, in many cases, years, and are being told this isn't treatment that you need. This is optional, or this is, in some cases, claimed to be dangerous to them when there's a long-term medical record indicating that's not the case.
They're told that by medical staffs, or that's a decision made by an emergency contact, a proxy, a family member?
I've seen it go either way. In some cases, it's because that person's family is making decisions for them because they're incapacitated. In some cases, it's something where they're not necessarily given any contact. And in that case, they're like, that's part of the reason why being able to dictate which facility you may want to be seen by is completely necessary, because there are facilities within the city that I absolutely would not want to be treated by.
Still here now?
Yes. Okay. As recently as a couple months ago, I've had an issue with a major facility in the area. And it's a lot of the time, it's just a level of ignorance. But when you're unable to advocate for yourself, I'm comfortable advocating for myself in a lot of situations. But if I were unable to have those conversations, those people wouldn't know how to treat me in a fashion that would be in line with what I need.
So this is instructive and really helpful for us to understand. So let me just follow up, and I don't, what I don't want to do is ask too far across the lines.
No, you're okay.
Okay. So what's your expectation when you need care or treatment, and when things have not gone well at certain facilities? What does that look and sound like?
I mean, one of the most recent incidents was I actually was going to a consultation for top surgery, which is an explicitly transgender-related procedure. So you would think that the people that you're interacting with in that situation would understand and respect, at least on a basic level. I was misgendered by the staff downstairs. I was asked, you know, what my name was prior to changing it. To clarify explicitly, it was not in any medically relevant context. It wasn't something where it was, you know, we need to access your old records. Might they be under another
name? Out of curiosity?
Yes. And it was openly admitted to be out of curiosity by a doctor who still is probably being referred to by some people in the city for top surgery consultation and surgery. And it became very evident over the course of that visit that achieving results that bettered people's lives was not really the primary concern. It was something that this person was kind of doing on the side in addition to other surgeries they did. Not to say that they were doing so negligently, but if you're looking at getting care and you want to make sure that you're getting the best care, those are concerns that people have to grapple with if they're dealing with transgender care or even trying to do things like family planning and are LGBTQ and have separate concerns, sexual health. If somebody does not understand and respect and actually value your well-being in that way, you don't get the care that other people get in that situation.
Hmm. How do you typically respond in a moment where you're asked by a doctor? And by the way, is the term, because Mile, I think I heard you use the term earlier, and this is, again, this is, I think, probably valuable for people to hear. You use the term dead name?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the term?
It's one of the terms for it.
One of the terms. Okay.
So dead naming is where you you call somebody by a name that they no longer go by, whether or not they've legally changed their name or not. If they're using a different name in everyday life, that in my mind is their common law name, it's their new name, it's the name they should go by. So dead naming is you know, accidentally or purposefully referring to somebody by a name that they no longer use in a way that's very painful and disrespectful to a trans person. And then
In medical context, requesting that information
when it's not relevant.
In some cases, it can be relevant. That's a more complicated situation. Mm-hmm. But even if it's required that you know for a reason, being clear that that's why you're asking or allowing somebody to write it down or submit it handle it in a different way.
Danny, I assume everyone's going to react differently in that moment. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're probably shocked to be asked that question.
Absolutely.
Do you let the staff know, hey...
I was actually with a friend of mine at the time who works for another major medical facility because I specifically brought someone with me to those appointments to have essentially a witness and somebody to help advocate. And both of us were honestly just shocked. That person had previously gone to that same surgeon. And neither of us, like, that's the problem is when you're confronted with those situations on the spot in that way, a lot of the time there's either not the time to respond or it's just a moment of, is this really happening? Like, I actually stood there and waited for a moment when the surgeon asked, just kind of expecting them to correct themselves and just, oh, my bad, or some kind of response to that extent. And just stood there in silence for a moment and finally said, I'd prefer not to answer that. And that was when the response was, oh, well, I'm always just curious as to how people pick a name. So it was very explicitly not in any way relevant to my care or anything that this person needed to know.
Okay.
Even in a context that was associated with that type of care.
So that interaction is obviously a problem. What are your biggest concerns in future interactions with medical staffs?
Interestingly, with that specific situation, I called another surgeon on the way out of that office. And that's why I bring up the level of understanding in reference to the quality of treatment. Because going to the second surgeon, the evaluation was so much more thorough. It wasn't, you know, we think we can achieve the sort of results you want. It was talking about conditions that I have that could have complicated it. It was talking about exactly what the procedure would entail, talking in detail about things that I could do before or after to better achieve the results that we were looking for, talking about concerns. Do you have any questions? You can contact me afterward. And that's the difference, is when those situations occur, it's a pretty clear indicator that that level of care in terms of differentiation is there. And it was very much the case in that situation where when I went to another office where the treatment was very different in terms of how I was respected, mm-hmm. it was also very different in terms of the level of treatment that was being offered and the level of attention to respecting somebody as a person and really meeting their medical needs.
You want to add to that, Myla?
I just want to take an opportunity to point out that it's important, I think, for folks who are listening who might identify with what Danny is talking about or experience something sort of similar, just to remind folks that there are really good protections under state and federal law for situations like this. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Please do. Under federal law, under the Affordable Care Act, which is often known as Obamacare, there is a non-discrimination provision that's still in play, despite best efforts by an administration to not make it so, that prohibit hospitals and healthcare facilities that receive federal funding, which is the vast majority of them, from discriminating against people based on their sex, including trans status. And under state law, our human rights law very clearly protects people based on trans status, gender identity, gender expression, and sexual orientation, as well as the disability of gender dysphoria, if you identify as having that in places of public accommodation, which include hospitals, doctor's offices, and emergency rooms. So just as a FYI, that is...
Yeah, and it's absolutely good information to have. I think the caveat is that a lot of the time the situation is more immediate than the remedy is.
Of course.
So you can definitely follow up with those sorts of things, but having things like advanced directives in place help to avoid getting into those situations, particularly when it's coming from a place of saying, I have experience with this practitioner, like for instance, inpatient mental health care. If you know of a facility or you know that a facility has that record, you can avoid things like being denied treatment while you're in care for a different condition by saying, I don't want to be treated by this facility, or when I'm in a facility, this is what I expect in terms of care.
When you go to medical facilities now, do you have more of an expectation that things will be appropriate, or more of an expectation that you better be prepared for things to be not there yet?
I think for a lot of folks in my position and similar positions, there's always a kind of assume the worst and hope for the best scenario, and I've had some great experiences. I've had actually a practitioner call after a visit and apologize for misgendering me. In that case, I hadn't even noticed it at the office visit, and they kind of followed up and were like, I'm very sorry this happened. I just didn't, like, I hadn't corrected them, but they acknowledged, like, even though you didn't correct me, I don't know if you noticed it. I don't know if it was hurtful to you, and I want to apologize if it was.
Does that have, what does that mean to you? Is that helpful?
Yeah, it's absolutely helpful, because had I noticed it, again, I probably wouldn't have said anything. I didn't say anything directly to the person in the other case either. But by somebody following up, it kind of splits the difference between that expectation that this person doesn't really understand my needs, because they are actually saying, I made a mistake and I'm apologizing for it and I understand that it wasn't appropriate.
Well, I'm late for our only break of the hour. Let's get that break, and we're going to come back. And some of the things you've been hearing about, advanced directives, Danny brought up, legal documents. We've got a couple of attorneys here. We can ask how you actually get those documents, what it actually takes. We've talked about what it means to start thinking about putting together kind of a frame for an obituary and where you might be able to keep those and who you might want to be in touch with about these things. All things that a lot of good information for everybody, but in particular the LGBTQ plus community. This is not just an elder care fair tomorrow. It is really something, it's a life fair for people in the LGBTQ plus community. So let's get that break and continue the conversation next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, the IPCC is out with its new report on climate change, and it is dark. Scientists are saying that we are closer than ever to catastrophic climate change, and many of the estimates have been too conservative. In other words, some grim times ahead if we don't make significant changes. So what kind of changes do we need to make? We discuss it Monday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I think Danny Palmer talking about his experience in the medical setting now as someone who, well, you're not an elder yet by technical definition. I don't think Danny. Yeah. Danny's pretty young. And I think that's emblematic of what the point Katie Adamidis was making earlier about there's an elder law fair tomorrow. Get ahead of things. If you've got questions, if you've got concerns of what may be happening now in your life, and certainly in the future. But I opened the program by talking about this film that I think is really worth finding if you can. It's called Gen Silent. It's about 7 or 8 years old now, a documentary film following the lives of half a dozen LGBTQ plus seniors and revealing how difficult their legal situations, their interactions with nursing homes and related facilities can be, and touching on the fact that gay people who have felt, people in the LGBTQ plus community who have sort of come through this generation, come out of the closet, are at times choosing to deny their own identity just to make sure they can get care, just to make sure they can stay in certain settings, et cetera. I'm going to assume, Milo and Katie, that if you are in a nursing home, if you're in an assisted care facility, you've got all kinds of rights that they should not be able to take away from you. But let's talk a little bit about that. Maybe you know an older gay couple. Maybe you know a single gay person who, again, we know that they live in isolation more for various reasons. First of all, I'm going to assume they cannot try to counsel you in any way, in the same way that we don't, this country is slowly moving away from the praying the gay away and related services that do all this kind of harm. I assume that facilities can't really do that legally. You can't try to counsel you out of your own identity, et cetera.
That's right.
Okay.
Yes. Again, under federal law, that sort of thing is not allowed. And the vast majority of these facilities receive some sort of federal funding. I mean, if they accept Medicare, which most of them do, that's their lifeblood. They are bound by federal law not to discriminate against people in those housing situations and healthcare situations in nursing home facilities, assisted living, that sort of thing. They have to respect your sexual orientation and gender identity exactly as is. Do they always follow the law? No. And I think that that's a huge problem. And people's choice to stay silent about their identities for fear of bias, for fear of neglect and elder abuse and elder neglect is enormous. Folks in that generation of the baby boomers who are entering these facilities are statistically less likely to have supportive family members who are keeping an eye on them to make sure that they're being treated with respect and being treated well, and also are less likely to have children or grandchildren who are visiting who are supportive. So it really, it's a very vulnerable part of our community. But even short of that, before going into assisted living or nursing homes, access to equitable and safe housing for LGBTQ elders, period, is actually a big issue.
What can be done about that?
That's a good question. It's something that community centers, LGBTQ community centers, are trying to tackle across the state. I know here in Rochester, the Out Alliance has a very, very active SAGE program, which is meant to target aging and elder LGBTQ folks in the local area, provide regular programming. They're constantly doing great programming, including free lunches, euchre, tournaments, and I think yoga for folks, which is great. But I think that providing that sense of community and networking and resources for that group of folks is really key. But taking that to the next level and making sure that we have appropriate and safe housing options for folks is also hugely important.
Katie, the documentary film touched on how discrimination sometimes is very overt. I mean, literally staff members trying to counsel the gay out of people, or you know, these things that are just sort of horrifying and obvious. But then there's discrimination that may happen among other residents, staff members doing things that will make life a little more uncomfortable, or et cetera, that may not meet certain thresholds. And I wonder what recourse people ought to know about or have in those situations.
Yeah, so it sounds like, Evan, you might be describing microaggressions in the medical setting.
Yeah.
And that's a very real phenomenon. I think it's yet another reason to think ahead about how you want stuff to go so that you can make choices and have documents and have a bedside advocate, have someone there. Because the reality is we've got a cultural problem, okay? And we can't fix that overnight, but certainly overnight you can get advanced directives in place. You can get counsel from an attorney and know, you know, worst case scenario, what are my next steps? 1, 2, 3. What do I want to have happen? Who do I trust?
All right. So advanced directives, you brought that up. You could do that pretty quickly?
Sure.
So you want advanced directive. What's the process look like?
Okay. So if you're most concerned about the healthcare setting, you don't even need a lawyer to do it. But having a lawyer is always great. If you're already going to get other documents done, then it's best to get counsel all at once. There's free healthcare proxies available online from the New York State Department of Health. I know Excellus was publishing a booklet for free that they're updating right now with the new MOLST form, which is Medical Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. Don't worry about that acronym. It's the hot pink form if you want to deny care. So these things are available. Your doctor's office probably has some on file if you want to fill one out next time you go in. And when we say advanced care planning, we usually mean healthcare. If you want to do a power of attorney, get a lawyer. You don't need a lawyer, but I strongly urge everyone to get a lawyer. It's complicated in New York State, and you don't want to make an invalid document.
A power of attorney is complicated in New York State?
Yes, yes. It's easy to make an invalid power of attorney in New York State. It's not a hard document to do, but you got to know what you're doing, and most people just don't. There are lawyers who do them for free in the community. I am one of them.
Do you charge for anything?
Not me. Not my firm. No.
Katie is staff attorney at Legal Assistance of Western New York. It always seems like you're doing all of these important things for free.
Why, thank you.
Every time you're on the program, it seems like you charge for nothing. No, that's important. So power of attorney can be complicated. Make sure that you've got it correct from someone who knows what they're doing there.
Do it with a lawyer. Do it early. Don't wait. No harm in doing documents that you never use.
Okay. Milo, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I wanted to point out a really good resource that's also available for free online. It's from the New York State Attorney General's Office Healthcare Bureau. They created a document called Advanced Directives, Making Your Wishes Known and Honored. It breaks down all of these different documents that we've talked about in a way that makes perfect sense. There's no legalese. It's actually in plain English, which is helpful because sometimes attorneys have a hard time speaking English. I know I do. But it breaks down each one. It talks about why one is important and how they work together. And it also points you toward other places you can find some samples and templates and things. And the other thing I would want to point out very quickly is that even if you are not income eligible for free legal services, like through the Legal Assistance of Western New York, thinking about advanced health planning and quality of life planning that we're talking about here, it's sometimes characterized as estate planning. And when people hear estate planning, they think, oh, that's only for rich people. And I am not, you know, maybe I'm not, I wouldn't consider myself low income, maybe I'm middle income or somewhere in the middle. This is for everyone, and it should be accessible to everyone. And there are attorneys who will do it for sliding scale fees or flat rates that are reasonable and accessible. So don't be scared away by the idea of talking to an attorney. There are people who will do it at a good rate.
All right. I want to get a listener question in just a moment, but I want to hit one point before we move on here that Milo sent before the program began about unwed partners. On your list of concerns here, Milo, is unwed partners not being allowed to visit or make medical decisions. Mm-hmm. Is that an issue for straight couples as well? Or is this a particular concern in the LGBTQ plus community?
No, it's a concern for anyone okay. who is in a significant relationship with someone but does not go through the steps to become legally married or to have a domestic partnership. That would be recognized such that it gives them agency to create these things. But as Katie pointed out earlier, even if you are married, it doesn't give you full blanche right to make all the decisions about everything. We are past the point in our country, at least, where your spouse is property. So you do continue to be individual people with individual rights, even if you're married. And so there are some things that even marriage won't give you. And so whether or not you're actually married, if you are in a relationship with multiple significant partners, you know, all of these things are important to put these things in writing so that the people who are significant in your life, your loved ones, your trusted ones, are able to visit you and also able to make decisions on your behalf if that's what you want.
All right, here's an email from a listener named Angie who says, Evan, this conversation is still a little narrow. Can your guests address what these issues mean for people who are gender fluid?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the whole point of this, and thank you for bringing that to our attention, for non-binary, for gender fluid people, gender queer people, the whole idea is that you can and absolutely should take the steps necessary to maintain your body autonomy and your identity autonomy throughout your lifetime and throughout your the times of your life where you're going to be the most vulnerable to other people making decisions on your behalf. And this absolutely still applies to people who are non-binary or gender fluid in some way, to say that, you know, this is the way that I want my body to be treated. This is how I want my identity to be recognized and respected. It absolutely applies in those situations as well.
Okay. Katie, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think, you know, when we start to leave the healthcare setting, your gender marker or gender identity becomes less centralized, and it becomes more about who do you want to have property rights, property access, and that applies to everyone. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of always trying to encourage people to think about this before they need to think about it, because at the point that you needed it in place, it's too late. And that's the struggle of any attorney practicing in this area, is you're going to have people approach you, and they're usually led there by a friend or family member when they really aren't able anymore to engage in an attorney-client relationship and do documents. So yes, absolutely. Non-binary folks, gender fluid folks, this applies to you.
And Katie, what's the most common either mistake or issue that people are probably not planning for, not preparing for?
I think that's a great question. I think a lot of people think that if they, like Milo said, if they're not wealthy, then they don't need to worry about this stuff. Mm-hmm. And while it certainly simplifies your portfolio, it doesn't simplify things like, well, who has the rights to tell the utility company to stop billing your house when you're in a long-term care facility? Or, you know, if you're having restricted resources, is just as much of a reason to be careful with them as having a lot of resources. So I think failing to have those directives in place falls a lot on people who don't enjoy the privilege of wealth, don't enjoy these privileges of access. And so you kind of get a lawyer as needed, and when you need it, it might be a little late.
All right. So tomorrow, the Elder Law Fair is located where, Katie?
Monroe Community Hospital. It's bright and early, 7:45 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. All different topics are going to be covered. And although it's called the Elder Law Fair, we encourage people of all ages to come get free legal information.
Free legal information. I'm going to take the last few minutes of this hour because we have the opportunity to ask Danny Palmer, if you don't mind, since we We've been talking about a wide range of subjects that relate to the LGBTQ plus community. And I'm curious to know how you view the landscape of rights right now. And we've been talking, obviously, about the medical setting, et cetera. But, you know, the word progress means different things to different people. And it's an interesting time in this country. I'm curious to know how you feel right now.
Yeah, I mean, I specifically moved to New York because there are better protections than there are in a lot of the country currently for people specifically that are transgender.
Move from where, if you don't mind?
Virginia.
Okay.
Which is all kinds of not good for those sorts. Yeah, like there's not a whole lot of anything in the state of Virginia to protect even folks on the basis of sexuality. And it was a decision that I made consciously. It was a decision that I made knowing that there weren't very many people up here that I knew at the time. And that was still worthwhile to me, given the risks. And it had gotten to the point where I was looking into pursuing things like medical care. And in that area, there was a very real possibility that I'd be denied care or that I'd be treated differently by unrelated medical practitioners on the basis of receiving transition-related care. And I think the point of non-binary folks was brought up. I think those folks suffer that even more. Even places like here, where there is a working understanding at most facilities of what it means to be transgender and what care is medically appropriate, there are still assumptions made as to what's best for people instead of asking that person or that person being allowed to advocate for themselves as to what they want. And I think that's what it comes down to, is as far as where we are with rights, there are guidelines in place, but a lot of those things are essentially good faith gestures at this point, where they were put forward as temporary resolutions or as kind of patchwork, and they may change. And that's a very real issue for people that need, like, I'm going to need access to various transition-related care for the rest of my life. So this isn't something where if there's something that's in place for 5 years that's at risk if a new governor is elected or government offices change, that I can continue to rely on. And I think that's the most concerning thing about where rights are currently, is that there are active attempts to undermine a lot of those rights and successes in some cases to weaken or overturn, especially federal level protections right now.
For obvious reasons, for a long time in this country, not the only but probably the biggest frontier was equal marriage. And that frontier, obviously, that was achieved. So is there a biggest frontier sort of on the legal side or right side that stands out to you?
It's interesting to me that you say that it was achieved, because there are still a lot of issues for folks with disabilities relating to marriage law. And that's kind of one of the things that comes into play with these directives as well, is things like you may not be able to get married to your partner without risking access to medical care or access to certain types of insurance. Hmm. So if that's your reality, you do have to use documents like these and steps like these to protect you being able to be treated with dignity.
It's a powerful point that you're right. I hadn't considered. Milo, is there a sort of a frontier or a next block that you want to knock down?
I mean, I wouldn't mind knocking down the whole system, to be honest. Patriarchy? That would be fine. We could knock that down. You know, everyone talks about the trans civil rights movement being the new civil rights movement and the next civil rights movement. I think that addressing that is hugely important, but, you know, addressing the institutionalized racism and ableism and classism that continues to exist in our country and undermines all the other efforts that we're making really is the core of the thing. And it's the thing that we dance around the most because we don't know enough about it, or we're uncomfortable talking about it, or we're not sure if we're going to offend people if we bring it up. And the truth is, you know, a civil rights movement centered around quote unquote trans identity or trans issues is not going to be successful without keeping those other issues at the core, and making sure that any movement we have or any next frontier is an anti-racist movement, is an anti-ableist movement, an anti-classist movement. So yeah, dismantling the patriarchy would probably be, and you know, would probably be a good place to start.
Oh, I take that the point that you're making of sort of linking all of these things together, right, and not losing sight of them. I also think of, for example, the so-called the Women's March, January 20th. 2017, mm-hmm. after the inauguration of the current president. And some of the criticism was too many priorities, too many things. You know, you have to be focused on an agenda if you're going to be able to accomplish points on an agenda. And if it's too overarching, it's hard to focus it. So
who says that?
Well, okay, fair.
I'm going to give you an example of who
said that. Hillary Clinton said that to Black Lives Matter organizers in Boston during the campaign. She said, "We all want rights for everyone, but what is your agenda? What is the platform?" Of course, to state the obvious now, there is a platform for Black Lives Matter and et cetera, but that's one person who was making that point.
Right. And I think, though, that that, you know, even Hillary Clinton is coming from a paradigm of looking at this through a very specific lens and a process of movement organizing and political organizing that still plays by the rules of the old guard, which is largely, you know, white, cisgender, which means non-transgender, straight men. And the rules were created by them to protect them and to keep sort of the status quo in place. And I don't know that I agree that we have to follow those rules in order to get things done.
All right, well then, Katie, last word goes to you here. What do you make of it when the president says it's a hard time for men in this country?
Well, I can't comment on the president in my capacity at Law New York, but I do think what I should do with this time on the air with Law New York is call in the legal profession and call in the medical profession, because all those aggressions we were talking about, Danny's experience, those are things you can learn to stop doing and start learning best practices, and it's your responsibility to have done that yesterday. You're going to make mistakes. Keep at it.
Keep showing up.
All right, Senator Adametis, you dodged that question skillfully. but in your capacity as an attorney, I understand. Katie is staff attorney at Legal Assistance of Western New York. Thanks for being here. Appreciate your time here.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Milo Primo, LGBTQ+ civil rights attorney and founder and CEO of Just Roots Consulting. Nice having you back here. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
And nice to meet Danny Palmer. Good luck to you. Thanks for sharing your story. Really appreciate your experience and the comments you made here today. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Gary Putup doing the work behind the glass today. Thank you, Gary. Megan Mack is producer of Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely weekend. Hope you're surrounded by love wherever you go, and we'll talk to you Monday.